All right. Well, by my watch, it is 7 o'clock sharp, and in typical CAP fashion, we will get started right on time. We want to welcome those of you who are joining us and who have been with us for the last few minutes in this Zoom conference tonight, where we're covering Dobbs v. Jackson. This is perhaps the most important and consequential conversation in the history of the pro-life movement in the last 50 years. So we want to welcome you as we discuss this case. Tonight, we're going to break this case down. The oral arguments that were heard last week before the Supreme Court. With me tonight are two powerhouse members of the Center for Arizona Policy team who were present last Wednesday in Washington, D.C. on the steps of the Supreme Court. With me tonight are Center for Arizona Policy's Communications Director, Cindy Dahlgren, and also CAP President Kathy Herod. And before Kathy takes it away, and again, we're going to try and cram all of this information into 60 minutes. That's a tall order. But I would be remiss if we didn't open this event tonight with a word of prayer. So let's do that together, shall we? Our Father in heaven, we thank you for the occasion that brings us together, Lord. What we're about to hear is truly momentous, and that is a significant and definite word as we consider what this case might do. So we come together tonight to pray for an end to abortion in this land. Father, if you so will it, use this case as a tool to chip away at the foundation and destroy this evil practice in this land. Lord, use us. Hear the prayers, the righteous prayers of your remnant in this country. Lord, help us to be wise and perceptive of what you're doing. So thank you for these two women who are wise and have really been reading and preparing for this presentation so that we might be informed. So God, would you bless? Thank you for Center for Arizona Policy and for the ministry friends who make this work possible. God, would you bless us? And again, we just thank you for what you're doing in our country, that we're able to even prayerfully anticipate the end to Roe v. Wade in the United States. And it's in Jesus' name that we do pray. Amen. Kathy, take it away. You're muted. There you go.
All right. How long have I been doing this? Unmute. So welcome, everyone. Cindy and I are delighted to be with you tonight. What a privilege and a real treat it was for Cindy and I to be outside the U.S. Supreme Court last Wednesday morning when the justices were hearing this very important what we call the Dobbs case. Never say never. And I was thinking about this today because, you know, really never in my lifetime did I think I would be sitting here talking to you about Roe versus Wade being overturned in the United States of America and abortion no longer being legal. I learned to not say never, but this one is probably the biggest never that I would have thought. Never did I think I would be at Center for Arizona Policy for 25 years. Never did I think that CAP would be owning a building like we do now, thanks be to God. But really, to think that we are on the precipice of Roe versus Wade no longer being the law of the land is truly historic. It's truly a watershed moment, to use that term. And it's truly something that only happens because people like each one of you for the last 49 years have stood in defense of life, have not given up, have persevered, and have known that this day could be possible. And so how exciting it is. On our side in the Dobbs case, we had something like 80 or 82 what's called amicus briefs filed. Reflected on that. Here I'm a licensed attorney. I almost dropped out of law school. My father told me not to drop out because we didn't know how the Lord would use it. And so here I was able to sign a brief as a female attorney saying why women do not need abortion as a legal right for equality or anything else. That because that's what the pro-abortion side is saying, is that without abortion, women cannot advance in society, women cannot hold certain positions, et cetera, et cetera. And that is just such baloney. I don't know what else to call it. So that, and then as well as Center for Arizona Policy was able to sign a brief on behalf, along with my colleagues from around the country, family policy councils, a novel Ninth Amendment argument giving the justices just one more avenue with which they could reconsider Roe and Casey. So with that, it's been a fun week. Cindy got me on Sunday Square Off with Bram Resnick. That was this Sunday morning. So it's been interesting to see and watch the other side. I don't know, Cindy, any opening comments before I launch into the law?
No, why don't you start there? That's a good place to start.
Okay. So let me first say what the Mississippi law is. It's an issue, and the name of the case is Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Whole. I'm sorry, let me slow down a bit. Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Organization. And Mississippi passed a law to limit abortions after 15 weeks gestational age of the unborn child. You know, typically a lot of people think it's viability, that it's 24 weeks, it's different times. This was intended to be a strategic move to be a direct challenge to Roe versus Wade and the Casey versus Planned Parenthood decision. So what do we know about Roe? We know that Roe in 1973 basically legalized abortion through all 9 months of pregnancy for any reason under the guise of either the life of the mother or the health of the mother because of the companion Doe case. Then Casey came along in 1992 when we thought, oh, we have a chance to overturn Roe. Obviously, that did not happen. Casey, in a sense, you know, it modified Roe. It affirmed Roe, but it also changed significant parts of it and went into this undue burden standard that an abortion restriction would be constitutional as long as it didn't create an undue burden on the woman's so-called right to have an abortion. So we've been living under this kind of vague standard of undue burden standard since 1992 and, of course, under Roe since 73. So to give you a sense, with Mississippi, what happened when Mississippi passed this law was, of course, it got challenged in court by the Center for Reproductive Law and Policy in Jackson on behalf of this Jackson's health organization and abortion clinic. And the person who argued our side in court was Scott Stewart, the Solicitor General and the Mississippi Attorney General's office. And what a blessing Scott Stewart was to be the one in court arguing this case. He had been a clerk, a Supreme Court clerk for Justice Clarence Thomas, and so he was familiar with court procedure, but still, it was the first case he had argued before the U.S. Supreme Court. So just, you know, stop for a minute and think about this is the first case that he argued, and what a moment, how could a case of such extreme importance. But here, I just have to repeat over and over again how he started his argument. Roe versus Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey haunt our country. They have no basis in the Constitution. They have no home in our history or traditions. They've damaged the democratic process. They've poisoned the law. They've choked off compromise. For 50 years, they kept this court at the center of a political battle that it can never resolve. And 50 years on, they stand alone. Nowhere else does this court recognize a right to end a human life. I mean, those words should be words that should be remembered for many, many years to come because they very much characterize where we're at, that those decisions do haunt our country. So what's at issue with the 15-week limit? It's what's called the viability rule. To date, the U.S. Supreme Court has not allowed states to regulate abortion, to prohibit abortion prior to viability of the unborn child. Now, a lot of people think that viability is 24 weeks, that you can't have an abortion after 24 weeks. But what's viability? It means that the unborn child is viable, is able to live outside the mother's womb. But of course, we all know viability is not at 24 weeks. It's a moving target. We've seen babies have survived as early as 21 weeks, 22 weeks. I hear occasional reports even at 20 weeks. So viability is different in every pregnancy. And so you can't just say that there's this bright line marker that, oh, okay, the child's all of a sudden viable outside the mother's womb. It's one of the key ways I would say that science has changed since 1973 because we know that science, medical technology is able to save babies that are have their lives threatened or, you know, possible miscarriage, whatever it might be, that babies are surviving when they're born earlier than 24 weeks. Probably in 73, I don't know what viability was, but it certainly wasn't even 24 weeks. So the 15-week limit in Mississippi was very definitely crafted as a legal strategy to challenge Roe versus Wade and Casey. There are really three paths that we see going on in the courts right now to challenge Roe. The 15-week limit from Mississippi is the key one, obviously, before the court now. The Texas heartbeat law is another possible option, but it's important to note that before the U.S. Supreme Court right now is not the constitutionality of the Texas heartbeat law, but it's whether the private citizen enforcement action, a different enforcement mechanism than we typically see in laws, whether that is procedurally acceptable or not. We don't have a court ruling on it. We don't know what they're going to say. But again, it's not going to go to the merits of Roe versus Wade and Casey versus Planned Parenthood. Then the third option in the courts is what we call the non-discrimination bans, which is like what passed under Senator Nancy Bartow's leadership in the legislature this last session to prohibit abortions that are due solely to genetic abnormality of the unborn child. So that's where we are as far as the different, what's going on as a legal theory. But the 15-week limit is intended to be absolutely a direct challenge to Roe and to do away with the viability rule because, as Solicitor General Stewart also said, this undue burden standard from Casey is the most unworkable standard in American law because no one knows what undue burden standard means. It's a subjective. It's not objective. It's not a bright line marker. It's whatever that court is going to determine it to be, and that's where we are. So the Mississippi law was overturned by the lower courts, by both the Federal District Court and the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, and then the U.S. Supreme Court took the case. Now, this case is unique for many reasons, but one key reason is that there wasn't what's called a division in the Circuit Court of Appeals. Usually the U.S. Supreme Court doesn't take a case until you've got two different Circuit Court of Appeals, like our Ninth Circuit disagreeing with the Fifth Circuit on a similar case. There is no division among the circuit courts of appeals. This is the only state that has passed a 15-week limit. There have been other states at 20-week limits, I believe one at 18-week limits. So this is a case of first impression before the U.S. Supreme Court with no split in the circuits, and they took something like 2 years before they decided whether or not to accept the case. Again, very unusual. And so the timing, might it be God's timing? Time will tell. But this is just interesting. But, you know, the lawyer in me that is fascinated by the process of all of this, it's just interesting to kind of see how do all of those little factors play into everything. One thing that we're very grateful for is that the Mississippi Attorney General, Lynn Fitch, that she did ask the Supreme Court to overturn Roe and Casey. She could have just asked the court to uphold the 15-week limit, but she decided to go right for the jugular, to go right at saying, basically, you need to overturn Roe and Casey. It's very, and I'll talk about the options for what could happen, but it's really hard to see how the court could uphold the 15-week limit, do away with the viability rule, and not overturn Roe and Casey. Now, the court can do anything they want to do, as we well know, but it's hard to see that. So that's kind of where we are as far as, like, on the law and what we're looking at and what we saw going on at the U.S. Supreme Court, at least in the first part of it, how we got to the U.S. Supreme Court. So now, what was it like to be in D.C., to be outside the hearing? And I'll toss that over to Cindy to talk about a little bit as far as what it was like to actually be there with, what, thousands, Cindy, at least?
Oh, yeah. And we were so blessed to be there, to be part of history. And as much as we wanted to be inside, COVID kept us outside of the courtroom during the oral arguments. But that way we were able to be part of the rally that was outside. There was, yeah, well over 1,000 people there. Very exciting. A lot of speakers. And among them were some Arizonans. We had Arizona State Senator Nancy Bartow was there. Myra Rodriguez, you might remember her. She's a former Planned Parenthood director who won a multimillion-dollar lawsuit against Planned Parenthood Arizona. She now is speaking out about the abortion industry's deception and their commitment to money over women. And so that was a compelling speech as well. I was really struck by the difference in the tone between the two rallies, because there were sort of these dueling rallies going on, the pro-life and the pro-abortion rallies. And on the pro-life side, which was probably about twice the size of the pro-abortion side, but it was very uplifting. We had speakers, we had prayers, we even had singing toward the end. You know, people spoke about how far the pro-life industry has come, the development of the unborn baby at 15 weeks. stories of abortion and redemption, stories of survival. So very emotional stories as well. Abby Johnson, very compelling speaker. She apologized for hurting women. She got very teary-eyed and emotional and apologized for her years at Planned Parenthood where she believes she hurt women. Myra Rodriguez said a similar thing. But, you know, there was a lot of encouragement that, you know, this Dobbs case was a perfect opportunity to right that wrong. And then I went to the pro-abortion side to see what that was like. And it was very different. Even the feel was different. They were very angry. They were screaming into the microphone, just very demanding, you know, abortion at any time, at any stage of development, for any reason. They were calling us, you know, bigots and racists for some reason. And just very, you could tell they had a sense of the weight of things and that maybe they were on the brink of losing Roe. And so I think the saddest thing that I saw was the video of those three women who stood in front of a pro-abortion sign and they took the abortion pill. They said, "We're going to take this abortion pill and kill our babies right here at this rally." It was devastating. I mean, to watch them, they waited till the cameras were all there. They showed the box of pills. They took one out. They, you know, opened a thing of water and took those pills. And it was just heart crushing to see that. And I just was praying that it was a stunt and that it wasn't real, but just to see that sort of callousness and that audacity. And it was just it was devastating. And you juxtapose that with the pro-life side where, you know, they're using the hashtag empowering women, protecting life. You know, there were signs that read, you know, science proved us right. And things like that. It was just a very different feel. And so Kathy, you and I were listening in our ear online to the oral arguments while all of this is going on. And, you know, since the analysis has been overwhelmingly indicating that the court is poised to uphold the Mississippi law, if not go ahead and overturn Roe and Casey. Although, again, as you said, you never want to predict what SCOTUS is going to do, especially when there's a lot that could happen between now and June or when the ruling will come down. You know, but I was reading independent news outlets. They were even expecting some type of pro-life outcome to some degree. And but I did read some center-left analysis saying that the pro-lifers are fooling ourselves if we think that the court will overturn Roe. So I thought that was interesting, but maybe just because it's been 40 years. But there was a lot said by the justices, questions and comments that really gave that indication. Kathy, maybe you can talk a little bit about that, what they were saying.
Well, I think it's important to note that we've already had a significant victory just in the fact that we were at the U.S. Supreme Court with a very reasonable, well-reasoned legal debate among the justices on what should happen. So as I've got, you know, the transcript here with me, I've kind of done my little post-it notes and, we were listening with our ears and trying to really follow the justice arguments while we were out in front of the court. But a key part, you'll hear this term over and over again, stare decisis. And that's the legal principle that basically says that court decisions are not overturned unless they are egregiously wrong. So, of course, the pro-abortion side is saying, oh, that absolutely Roe and Casey were decided correctly, that they're not egregiously wrong, while our side is saying, yes, they were egregiously wrong. So to kind of go through what we've seen from some of the different justices and just some of the comments, and you've probably heard some of these in the news, but Chief Justice Roberts, that may well be the pivotal vote and leader on what happens with how far the court goes in their ruling on this decision. He asked why Mississippi had asked for Roe and Casey to be overturned, that how it was different from other cases on stare decisis. The pro-abortion attorney, her last name was Reichelman from the Center for Law and Reproductive Policy. I think I have that right, as far as the actual name of the organization. We've seen that group many years opposing abortion restrictions in Arizona. But just Chief Justice Robert asked, what data was she talking about that shows that abortion was critical to women participating in society? So bravo, Chief Justice, to not let her get by with saying, oh, legalized abortion is absolutely essential to women's equal participation in society. He, Chief Justice, actually focused on that the 15-week ban is not that dramatic of a departure from viability. If viability is 20, 22, 24 weeks, 15 weeks isn't that dramatic of a departure. And he even pointed out, quote, when you get to the viability standard, we share that standard with the People's Republic of China and North Korea. It was almost amusing to hear Reichelman try to say, oh, you know, kind of almost like, you know, well, yeah, but that's not really, that's just a nominal line or something like some word like that that she used to try to act like, yeah, but these European countries, you know, they really, they're allowing abortions later in pregnancy as well. So that's just one of those kind of interesting things that no, United States of America is right there with China and North Korea and how extreme our abortion laws are. So for the chief to point that out, that was one of those momentous moments. He also, though, said at one point that he found Justice Breyer, one of the liberal justices, found his arguments and statements on stare decisis to be quite compelling. So that's the red flag right there. Okay, what's compelling about it, Chief Justice Roberts? We don't know. Everyone's looking to the newer justices, Kavanaugh, Amy Coney Barrett, Gorsuch. Where are they going to be on the life issue? We know that Justices Thomas and Alito have long argued in dissent that Roe should be overturned. Thomas was actually on the court when Casey was decided in 1992. But Justice Kavanaugh, his questions went to that the Constitution is silent on abortion, that the Constitution, that the court should be scrupulously, should be scrupulously neutral on the question of abortion. And then Kavanaugh went through a string of cases where precedent was overruled, where the court, you know, followed the stare decisis principle by saying that what was true at the time it was decision, either the decision was wrong or the science had changed or whatever. You know, the biggest example of that is when the U.S. Supreme Court did Plessy versus Ferguson that allowed racial segregation, and it took 58 years for the court to overturn that. And they did it through Brown versus Board of Education. So it's very hard for the other side to say, oh, well, stare decisis mean you should never change an opinion, because then you're saying Plessy versus Ferguson never should have been changed and racial segregation should be the law of the land. No one believes that today. No reasonable person, certainly. So that was just interesting that Kavanaugh went down that line. Justice Thomas repeatedly tried to get the other side to say, well, what constitutional right protects the right to an abortion? Like, where in the Constitution is a right to an abortion? Of course, they could not give a rational answer to that. Justice Barrett said that stare decisis is, quote, obviously the core of this case, and asked different questions about was it wrong the day it was decided? Is it wrong today? She also, the Solicitor General in response, this Scott Stewart, said that legitimacy of the court derives from the willingness to stand strong and to stand firm in the face of whatever is going on and stand for constitutional principle and follow our traditional stare decisis factors to overrule when it's appropriate. And I think that's one of our prayer requests, is that the justices would be standing strong and stand firm and follow really what stare decisis requires and overrule a decision that was wrong. Justice Barrett also, you may have heard, asked about safe haven rules. Because one of the arguments being made is that parenting is a burden on women and that women are relieved of the burden of parenting by being able to have an abortion. So Justice Barrett pointed out, well, all 50 states have what are called safe haven laws. What that means in Arizona is the woman who is pregnant and does not want to parent her child can, within, I think, up to 30 days after the birth of her child, take her child, her baby, to a safe haven facility, leave the child without any questions being asked. Her anonymity is totally preserved. And this, if you remember the horrible stories we heard of babies being left in trash cans and just left to die. And so this was an alternative. So many of our local fire stations are safe haven facilities to where the birth mother can have the baby safely at a hospital, then leave the baby at a safe haven facility and then that baby can be adopted by a loving family and have a forever home. So the other side had trouble kind of answering that question. And then, well, adoption's always been, you know, available. Well, you know, the difference between adoption and safe haven is that with adoption, the birth mother has 72 hours in Arizona to basically sign papers to terminate her parental rights. The birth father has up to 30 days to claim his parental rights. Well, I may have, don't, now let me start quoting adoption law. Let me just say that adoption law has certain requirements that for the birth mother and birth father, and what would happen in that case where safe haven, you don't have to ever know anything. You just leave the baby and that's it. And so it's just for those birth mothers who don't want to go through an adoption process, they can just leave their baby. So Justice Barrett was pointing that out as a viable option for the mother who doesn't want a parent. But of course, the other side says, well, the burden of pregnancy is so horrible that you're taking away the mother's liberty interest. When actually said that viability is dependent on medical technology and medical practice, and it has changed. It may continue to change. Bravo, Justice Alito. That's exactly it. Viability has changed dramatically. So then we get to the liberal justices. I mean, Cindy, thoughts on, I mean, Sotomayor, Kagan, Breyer, just the same political drivel that we hear every day?
Yeah, and what I thought was interesting is that none of them, and also the attorneys arguing the pro-abortion side, none of them defended the constitutionality of Roe. None of them even talked about that or even went down that road to talk about the foundational constitutionality of Roe. They all talked about, like you said, precedent, the reputation of the court. You know, they didn't want to be seen as political, but ironically, they were very political. And I just thought it was interesting. We didn't hear a lot from Kagan, but from Justices Sotomayor and Breyer came across, you know, frustrated, and they indicated that it would be ruinous to overturn precedent, you know, with no regard for what Roe, if Roe was rightly or wrongly decided. And we know that Chief Justice Roberts is overly concerned about, you know, the court's reputation. We don't know where that is in the priority of like righting wrongs or overturning precedent. He's very concerned about that. But he clerked for Chief Justice Rehnquist, who was very concerned about the legitimacy of the court coming from right rulings, even if it meant overturning precedent. And Chief Justice Roberts in the past, he supported overturning precedent in Citizens United v. FEC about in 2010. And I found a quote from him in National Review. It's short. He said, "When fidelity to any particular precedent does more damage to this constitutional ideal of rule of law than to advance it, we must be more willing to depart from that precedent." Which, okay, that was 2010, but it's encouraging. Again, we don't know what Chief Justice Roberts will do now, but it's encouraging that at least in the past he has seen reason to overturn precedent. And the other thing that I noticed was Justice Kagan was very quiet, almost completely quiet. And she's known for playing it cool and kind of talking to justices and trying to persuade them to her side behind the scenes. So I was just wondering during that if maybe some of that silence was part of that. I don't know if you had thoughts on that.
Well, Kagan, the few times that she did say anything, she said that she was concerned that people will think that, quote, this court is a political institution that will go back and forth depending on what part of the public yells loudest. Mm-hmm. Well, okay, that's a political argument. That's not a legal constitutional argument. And she also said at one point, not much has changed since Roe versus and Casey, which, you know, that's just wrong. Sotomayor, you just kind of, you can predict what some of them will ask. Sotomayor could not resist at one point saying, how is your interest anything other than a religious view? Mm-hmm. Because, of course, if they can make the pro-life movement be all about our faith views on life beginning at conception, then, okay, that's not a constitutional view or whatever. The Solicitor General really never answered that because they, you know, kept getting interrupted and they went on to other questions. So, when they, obviously, you know, those are a lot of political arguments, policy arguments were made by the other side, not legal constitutional ones. But that by the other side, this Ms. Reichelman, the attorney on the other side, some of the things that she says is, I mean, again, it's the political arguments that, quote, it will force women to remain pregnant and give birth against their will. quote, it's a fundamental deprivation of the woman's liberty. It will propel women backwards. The viability line has been endurably workable. I mean, it just defies it's just reality. It's like, how can they get by with these statements? But of course, we've seen that for the last 50 years from those that favor abortion.
Yeah, but I thought it was interesting that the Solicitor General, Scott Stewart, addressed that to some degree when he said, if the justices were arguing that, the case, that the court was trying to settle the issue in 1973 and then again in 1992 with Casey, that it didn't work. And 49 years after Roe, it's no more settled than it was on day one. And he said that, it's not going to be settled after Dobbs either, because it's not the court's place, it's the people's place. This is an issue for the people and for the states to decide.
And Scott Stewart's closing line, when he was able to do his rebuttal, reiterate this, quote, it took 58 years for the court to recognize the Plessy decision on racial segregation was wrong. Roe, quote, is an egregiously wrong decision that has inflicted damage on our country and will continue to do so and take innumerable human lives unless and until this court overrules it. So what a strong statement by a Solicitor General on behalf of the state of Mississippi. Bravo. So now it's like, what happens now? So the process, last Friday, typically this is how the U.S. Supreme Court operates. Last Friday, the nine justices would have met in a conference room at the court. Only the justices, clerks are not present, to take their initial vote on how they will rule on this case. So they'll talk about it. Justice Roberts is the chief, will take the initial vote. So it'll be, is it 5-4? Is it 6-3? Which way is it going to go? And then depending on how that vote goes, the Chief Justice assigns who will be writing the opinion. Then that justice will start writing the opinion along with his clerks. The dissenters, which there will be dissenters in this case, they will start writing their opinions. And then they will have months behind the scenes, more than likely months, of going back and forth with opinions. This will be one of those kind of complex legal decisions from the court where we will get multiple opinions. You'll get a majority opinion, a dissenting opinion, concurring opinions. And then we'll be left to sort out what all it means. And hopefully it's going to be the outright overruling of Roe. But here are the possible options. And I believe we have a graphic to show you the options. So the court can overturn Roe and Casey. And what that means is send abortion back to the states so that all 50 states decide what the abortion law is going to be in their state. They can uphold the Mississippi law but not overturn Roe and Casey and create some type of new standard on how these cases would be adjudicated. They might keep some kind of undue burden standard, but it's still hard to believe that how they uphold Mississippi without overturning Roe and Casey. Mm-hmm. Or they could flat out uphold Roe and Casey and say that the 15-week limit is unconstitutional. No one really believes that they will avoid the Mississippi 15-week limit. And even in my kind of mini debate with the local head of Planned Parenthood on Sunday Square Off, she agreed with me that we were looking at a time when the 15-week limit at a minimum would be upheld and that we likely may well be looking at overturning Roe and Casey. So what we need in a decision is we need them to overturn Roe and Casey, to do a decision that is rooted in the text of the Constitution, not a political decision like we saw in Roe or like we saw in Casey, but that is firmly rooted in the text of the Constitution, that the Constitution is silent on the issue of abortion. Now, you might say, well, wait a minute, all 50 states, so California, as the Planned Parenthood director says, is going to be a safe haven for abortion. Well, that's really the constitutional law principle, whether we like it or not, is that all the states would be deciding their own abortion laws. Now, one thing that I heard Mike Ferris, the CEO of Alliance Defending Freedom, say is that just the fact that, to stop and think, Roe legalized abortion. The courts can't legalize anything. That's up to the lawmakers. That's up to the executive and legislative branches of our three systems of our three branches of government. So I thought that was an interesting point, that judges don't legalize anything. They have to interpret the law. It's what lawmakers do. So this would turn it back to the lawmakers, and that's what we'd be looking at. Most will say, that, okay, it's going to be a decision in June. I think that's probably accurate. That's what we've usually seen on a big case The justice's term is from the first Monday in October through the last, usually June 30th. That's what we anticipate, that it'll be by June 30th. There have been many a June, Monday, and Thursdays that I've been at 7 a.m. sitting on the SCOTUS blog, the Supreme Court of the United States blog, waiting for a decision to come down. And my guess is that's what my June's going to be. But we'll be watching it. We'll be watching the court closely over the next few months to see if we see any signs. So that kind of leads us to the question of what's next. If Roe and Casey are overturned, what happens in Arizona? Well, Arizona does have pre-Roe law. It's actually a law that was on our books, I think, before statehood even, that says abortion is not legal except to save the life of the mother. That's what we want. That is our dream. That is our prayer. That is our hope, that the court does a broad enough ruling that overturns Roe and Casey, turns the abortion question back to the states, and we would maintain that Arizona's law preventing abortion except to save the life of the mother is back in effect. Whether that happens depends a lot on what the contours of the decision and how far the justices go. Now, what will happen then? Okay, so say our pre-Roe law is back in effect and law enforcement can enforce the law and abortion's not legal, the abortion clinics have to stop providing abortions. Two things that I think happen immediately. We get a state legal Planned Parenthood, the abortion industry, will file a lawsuit in state court alleging that our state constitution has a so-called right to privacy clause that allows a right to an abortion. That is baloney also, and I believe will not be a winning argument in our state courts or our state Arizona Supreme Court. The other thing that I believe the pro-abortion industry will do, they will raise the millions that it would take to put abortion on the ballot. That they will do 2024, they will at some point do some move to do an initiative drive, have enough signatures to put the question of abortion and to add abortion, legalized abortion, to our state constitution on the ballot. So we've got a lot of work ahead of us. And then I should say, really, the third thing they will do is everything they can in next November 2022's general election to elect a state legislature and a governor that will pass a law to legalize abortion in Arizona, because if Roe's turned back to the states, then our state election every 2 years, we could have a state legislature turn over and make a law to legalize abortion, to fund abortion with taxpayer dollars. And if they have a governor who is pro-abortion, then that governor would sign such a law. So that's a lot of political battles will be ahead of us, a lot of educating the public, and that's what we'd be looking at. When you talk about what happens in the next legislative session, I would ask for your prayers. There are a lot of strategic decisions to be made. Many of us love the concept of a heartbeat law that prohibits abortion like what Texas has had in effect since September 1st, that abortions are not legal in the state of Arizona. The state of Texas, we wish. Abortions are not legal in the state of Texas after the moment when a heartbeat is detectable in the unborn child, generally thought to be 5 or 6 weeks gestational age. That's in effect in Texas today. Well, think this through with me. If Roe is overturned, Arizona sets its own abortion law. We have a pre-Roe law in the books that outlaws abortion from the moment of conception. From the moment of conception is better than heartbeat. So that's the strategic decision on what Arizona does next. Do we have a 15-week limit sitting ready in the event that all the court does is uphold the 15-week limit but not overturn Roe? So lots of strategic decisions to be made as far as what we do next. And what's going to be what's going to really be before us. But obviously, when we talk about it, going back to the states, I mean, Cindy, as you all know, our goal is that babies are protected in every state in this union. And so when we look at the first 49 years, even if it takes us another 49 years or however long it will take us to try to have the unborn child and her mother protected from abortion. And let me mention, whenever we talk about abortion, we're as concerned about the woman walking into the abortion clinic as we are about her unborn child. So, Cindy, what do we need to know about messaging, and what do we need to be saying to our neighbors and in the public squares now?
Yeah, because it's just as important to, you know, we need to win this in the public square as well, not just, you know, we need to win it, let's say, in the court of public opinion, not just in the court of law. So, you know, Planned Parenthood has been telling women for decades that they need abortion. And we have to change those hearts and minds. So Ryan T. Anderson said that, you know, because the justices can be influenced by public by the public over the next few months, that our message has to be united and it has to be nothing less than overturning Roe. And it's important that we are united in the message because our work is not over regardless of which way Dobbs goes. And we must reiterate that life is a human right. Pro-abortion activists will say that abortion is a right, but no, life is a human right. And abortion law in the United States is extreme. Kathy, like you mentioned earlier, that I don't know if it was Kavanaugh or the Chief Justice, I think it was, that mentioned that we are among only a handful of countries that support abortion through all 9 months of pregnancy, and we're in the company of North Korea and China. Not good company to be in. And we also have to make sure that we're very clear and we get the information out there that there are countless resources for women who are facing unwanted or unexpected pregnancies. Also, women don't need abortions to succeed in life. This is one of the big talking points that I hear from the other side, and it's insulting. You know, you just think about the women in your life who have been both a mother and successful in their calling. I mean, just think of Justice Amy Coney Barrett. You know, she has, I think, 2 or 3 kids, maybe some a little bit younger, and you know, and she's a U.S. Supreme Court justice, so that does not hold water. But we have to keep countering that. And you'll hear that a majority of Americans support Roe. You will hear that women will die without Roe, and you will hear that, you know, no one will care for the babies, you know, that are not being aborted now, and now they are forced to be mothers. But none of this is true. I mean, the polling they use is showing 7 in 10 Americans don't want Roe overturned. That's the big talking point they use, and that's very misleading. And because a plurality of Americans also say that they support state control of abortions. So many of them don't understand that overturning Roe is exactly what that will do, is send it back to the states. Polling also shows that the current abortion laws, the extreme laws that we have now, are very unpopular, with only, get this, 13%. 13% of Americans, that's it, support elective abortions in the third trimester. And a Marist poll just earlier this year, very recent, shows that 3/4, that's a huge majority, 3/4 of Americans want some strict regulations on abortion. They want either abortion limited to the first trimester, or they want abortion limited to, you know, cases that are very rare, including the case to save a woman's life, or they want abortion entirely illegal. So 3/4 of Americans are in the in kind of our realm where we want it completely illegal, but they at least see that it needs to be strictly regulated. So, you know, we have to get that message out there, and we have to be united in it, and we have to understand, you know, the polling that they tout gives a completely warped view of where Americans are on this issue. And we have to remember that we're on the right side of this issue. We're right, and most of Americans are with us on that.
I can't emphasize enough how much we see, you know, in the past, if I would say someone was pro-abortion, I would get challenged on, oh, no, we're pro-choice on abortion. We're not pro-abortion. Mm-hmm. Well, now they're openly advocating pro-abortion. And just like what Cindy said about these women taking the abortion medication out in front of the U.S. Supreme Court, they're touting, they're celebrating their abortions. But also listen carefully when you hear the other side, because they're also saying pregnant people. Pregnant people. I'm sorry, it's women who get pregnant. It's not pregnant people. But that's where we are in this country, to allege that a female that's transitioning to being a male, or someone who says they're non-binary, whatever, that they can now get pregnant as well. So there's just a lot in the messaging, a lot that's going on. But we all know women who have been hurt by abortion, and we all know what ultrasound pictures are showing about the humanity of the unborn child. And so much of that is going in our favor right now that it's really important. So a little bit of what you can do, and again, if you want to put a question in the Q&A, we've got some questions coming in, and we'll be happy to answer any questions. But with what's ahead, what you can do, the first thing, obviously, is pray. There will be so much going on at the U.S. Supreme Court behind the scenes over these next few months. to pray for the nine justices, to pray for their clerks. When you think about 80 amicus briefs and how much they're having to read through those and digest the arguments and how they craft an opinion, and that the opinion be just the right language. There's what's called dicta, is the language in the court separate from the actual holding. That dicta is going to be extremely important for what it means about the direction of the court, about the direction of abortion in our country. So pray for the justices. Pray for all of us on the pro-life side, obviously your interactions with individuals. But as we prepare for the day after Roe, we are in active discussions, strategic discussions on the day after Roe and what that looks like and how we need to be prepared. Pray for these next, the 2022 elections. Engage in a campaign. Cindy is a messaging expert, as you can tell. So if you're involved in a campaign, if you're looking for messaging points for a candidate who's running for any office, state or congressional, statewide, and they need help on messaging, we are here to help. We want to provide the right kind of messaging on how to navigate these issues. As the Solicitor General from Mississippi said over and over again also, these are hard issues, and we want to recognize that these are hard issues, that a woman who finds herself in an unexpected pregnancy, these are hard issues. We're not minimizing the, what can happen to vulnerable women, and we're not only looking at the life of the unborn child, as I said before, but also the life of the woman. So any help with messaging, but I think most of all, it's really important for the pro-life community to keep united, to be united, to stay together, to be united in our strategy, to be united in our candidates. We may have some primary battles where you have different candidates, and all of us may be split on who we're supporting. But when we get to the November general election, where there's likely to be a very clear-cut distinction between the pro-life candidate and the pro-abortion candidate, we need to be very clear on that. Katie Hobbs, for example, a Democrat candidate running for governor, I can't tell you how many emails I get from her campaign touting her pro-abortion position and how extreme she is on abortion. I'm not endorsing or opposing candidates by that comment. I'm just saying that that's what we're going to be looking at. So it's important to remain united, to keep our eye on the main thing in a sense, and that's that after next November that we have a pro-life state legislature, a pro-life governor, a pro-life attorney general, because that's really what's going to matter to keep our state and that life is a winning issue and that we are a pro-life state and continue to be, as we like to say and hope to be, one of the most pro-life states in the country. So, okay, with that, we do have some questions. And one of them is, how strategic will the March and Life rally in Arizona on January 15th be and the other marches across the country and how to make the most of that? Let me just say, Arizona Life Coalition, a woman by the name of Tina Drake is, I think, chairing the rally. I think she's the main chair of the rally. A lot of people working on the January 15th Arizona Life rally. It is important. Plan to be there. Plan to march. At Center for Arizona Policy, our team will be there. We will be marching. Alveda King is the keynote speaker. But this is where we show we have a sign of support and force, that this is where we need thousands and thousands of Arizonans turning out, marching on the state capitol, show that we are pro-life and that we're going to vote pro-life. So encourage your churches, encouraging all your spheres of influence, participate with what Arizona Life Coalition is doing with the March for Life, the March and Life Rally. If you can go to D.C. for the annual March for Life, that's a week or 10 days after. I'm not going to get the date right, but it's there'll be, again, the annual March in D.C., and this is where, this is one way I believe that the pro-life movement has stayed strong through the last number of years, that we have indeed showed our strength by showing up and turning out. Another question, what would be the chance of remanding this back to the states where it belongs, as Justice Kavanaugh intimated? I think we've got a good chance. I mean, we've got obviously the best chance we've ever had. We're not going to know until we see the opinion, but I'm hopeful, more hopeful than I ever thought I would be. I mean, Cindy, any thoughts on that from everything you've heard and read?
Yeah, I'm very nervous to, try to predict anything that SCOTUS will do, but we have been reading a lot, you and I both, and that's the indication. I mean, even from SCOTUS blog, the day after the oral arguments, they came out and said the headline was something to the effect of, the court seems poised to uphold the Mississippi law, maybe even overturn Roe. So it sounds good. It concerns me all the things that can go on between now and the time that the opinion comes out, you know, sort of behind the scenes, but there were no red flags. That's what some of the analysis that we were reading, that there was nothing to indicate from any of the conservative justices that they were concerned or had some real concerns about doing this.
You know, when Justice Anthony Kennedy was on the court, and of course he's been one of our biggest disappointments on issues of marriage and human sexuality and abortion, that I remember hearing that things would be placed in the Washington Post intentionally because of a belief that Justice Kennedy read the Washington Post. Mm-hmm. And that's what we don't want. We want the justices looking at the law and the briefs and the Constitution. Someone has sent in a comment about fathers of the babies who are being considered for abortion are also important to address and support. Mm-hmm. And absolutely, this is another example of what court decisions have done. Court decisions have taken fathers out of the equation and have given the mother the sole decision on whether or not to have an abortion. So fathers have been powerless to decide or to help. You know, if the father wants to have the child and raise the child, they are denied that opportunity. And that is a travesty that has happened this entire 49 years. Now, the opposite of that, in a sense, is why does a woman have an abortion? Often the reason, I think most often the reason a woman has the abortion is because the father is not there, the support system is not there, and the woman, in a sense, doesn't know what else to do and needs that support. So we absolutely agree with that. And what's kind of interesting is that I think our pregnancy centers, and we have so many pregnancy centers throughout Arizona, they increasingly have done more and more as they work with post-abortive women for healing. They also have had support groups in which men who have not been able to protect their unborn children from being lost to abortion. So that's been exciting. Another question, do you think that justices have a threat against their lives that would sway their decisions? I don't think so, because I would, at least out of the six justices that are perceived to be the conservative justices, they all appear to be people of strong faith, people who believe in God, who practice their faith, who have been faithful through the years. And so I think that, I mean, my hope and prayer, I guess, is that their fear of God is greater than any fear of man and what man could do to them. That's certainly what I think those of us who've been leading in the pro-life movement, how we've looked at it. And I think their lives are also pretty well protected, that they have security, and that security will certainly be intense around the U.S. Supreme Court. Even, for example, when I was there for the Masterpiece Cake Shop oral arguments, our attorneys and Jack Phillips, they descended down the majestic steps in front of the Supreme Court from the court. They did not do that last week, but our attorneys came out of a side door, and there was fencing all around the U.S. Supreme Court. So it's still pretty secure in D.C. right now.
I think the real threat, Kathy, is them packing the Supreme Court, you know, for future rulings. The Biden administration and, you know, the majority in Congress have threatened that for quite some time now. I think that's more of a threat of packing the Supreme Court to get what they want rather than, you know, threatening the lives of any of them that are sitting.
And that's why when you heard talking about the legitimacy of the court, and that this is going to delegitimize the court, it's going to be a political decision, that they're going to overrule Roe, I mean, all that type, overturn Roe, that all is intended to getting to Chief Justice Roberts, who is viewed as being the one the most concerned about the integrity of the court and the threats that would come from court packing. Now, one of the interesting things on court packing is that President Biden did this major commission, and they went through all of the stuff about, you know, should they increase the number of the justices and all that. They could not reach an agreement. And so far, nothing is happening on that. But that's, again, where you live by the filibuster rule in the U.S. Senate and you die by it. And at least now they would not have the votes. They wouldn't be able to break the filibuster in order to bring a court packing, you know, plan before the Senate, at least. But that's an ongoing question. So the things to pray for, yes, somebody asked about that. Yes, we can send that in our follow-up email. We can send in our prayer, our weekly prayer and praise email that goes out on Monday. We can certainly continue to list to pray for and the names of the justices. And I think it's important to pray bold prayers and to pray prayers for each of them by name We don't know the names of their clerks, but we can still pray for them. They all, I think they each have maybe at least four, if not five clerks. And so, and these clerks are, they're not of small ability, or I should say, I don't know if that's the right way to put it, but they're like Harvard and Yale and top law schools, and they've usually clerked for an appellate court judge. So they're very seasoned attorneys and clerks that will be assisting the justices, and they certainly come in with their biases, and make no mistake about that, but that's important. Another question. Have you answered the threat that there will be back alley abortions where women will die if abortion is outlawed? Cindy?
That is greatly exaggerated. That that does not happen nearly as often, or it did not happen nearly as often as they purport it to happen. And if you look at the risks from the abortion pill, which is quickly becoming the way, the most, I guess, common way of getting an abortion over surgical abortions, there are far more risks to that, because a lot of women do not know really how far along they are in their pregnancy. And if you go beyond about 10 weeks, you are in a much greater risk of winding up in the hospital, getting surgery, and having complications. And I know the Charlotte Lozier Institute came out with a study showing that women who take the abortion pill are four times more likely to run into complications. Some of them are deadly complications. So that's a false argument, and it's just a way. And again, my answer right now would be Roe is not going to change that. It's not going to get rid of abortions altogether. Unfortunately, but it goes back to the states, and then the states do their own regulating.
And I often say that, well, abortion has moved from the back alley to the front of the abortion clinic in today's world. And so women are being hurt and injured by abortion today. Women are dying from abortions today. And the abortion pill is now 50% of abortions in Arizona. Pretty close to 50% of abortions throughout the country. As Cindy was talking about the harms of that. So women are still dying from abortion. Legalized abortion hasn't changed that. Abortion's not legal, safe, and rare. And so that's just such a, as Cindy said, it's just a red herring argument. Let me just kind of reiterate that another question that we kind of had is, okay, Roe is overturned. We've got the pre-Roe law in Arizona that outlaws abortion. Does it just automatically go back into effect? That will be our contention. We will put forth over and over again that if Roe is overturned, that Arizona's pre-Roe law, it wasn't enforced. We couldn't enforce it in our state because of Roe, that overturned the Texas law outlawing abortion, that therefore outlawed abortion in all 50 states, that now it is up to the state, then our pre-Roe law is back in effect. Now, you know, there could be something in the decision that prevents that, but that will be our contention. And it doesn't take a vote of the people. It doesn't take a vote of the legislature. It simply takes law enforcement being willing to go out and enforce the law. And so that's what we will be doing. That's what we'd be calling on law enforcement to do. So it's, I think those are the questions. I think it's time for me to toss it back to Chris to close us out in prayer. But let me just say, what an incredible moment in history we are in. What an incredible opportunity we have to stand for preborn babies and their mothers, and to advocate for life, and to advocate for candidates who will support and stand for life over this next year, really, especially between now and June and leading up to next November. So we thank you for taking the time to be with us tonight. Thank you for your stand for life and for your support to Center for Arizona Policy. We're very grateful. So, Chris, take us home.
Absolutely, and thank you to both of you ladies. I told you power packed. And lots to cover, and we've done it in 58 minutes, so I will finish strong here in about 2 minutes. I'm just sharing a couple of places where we can connect with you, to share with you places where you can find ways to pray on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. The address for all of those are AZ Policy. We also now have a podcast, which you can get on our website or If you're tech savvy and you have a podcast platform on your phone, mobile phone, you can get Engage Arizona, the podcast there as well. We're talking about a lot of these issues, and the two ladies on this conference tonight spoke with Senator Nancy Bartow just last week in live from Washington, D.C., so that's a lively podcast there. And then I want to invite you to our annual Capitol Prayer Walk on Monday, January the 10th, where we are going to surround the Arizona Capitol in prayer. And nothing of any great eternal spiritual significance is ever accomplished without prayer. And so all of these matters that we talk about, life, marriage, family, and religious freedom, require going before a holy God. So we're going to do that together at 7 a.m. early on Monday, January the 10th. So if you go to azpolicy.org/prayerwalk, very simple, the information is there, and we will be sending out an email of invitation this week. Lastly, I'm going to send in the chat a link to Sunday Square Off. I just did that, where you can click that link, and I'll keep it up until we're done. And if you haven't seen Sunday Square Off from this past Sunday, you can watch Kathy engage with the president of Planned Parenthood Arizona. And I think it will really, really give you hope that the message is pro-life. The winning message is pro-life. And so pray with me as we conclude tonight. Thank you for being with us, and God bless you. Let's pray. Father, we give you praise and honor and glory. You are a God of life. We are created in the Imago Dei, and that is why we want to uphold the sanctity of human life from its very beginning to its natural end. And to that end, God, we pray for the ultimate demise of abortion in the United States. So, God, thank you for the information that we've heard tonight. God, we pray for these 9 justices of the Supreme Court, for their clerks, for the contemplation that they will give over these weighty matters over the next many months. Father, we will be a people of prayer in our prayer closets, in our churches, around our kitchen tables for the next months, and then together also, and we're doing that now, and we pray this in the name of Jesus together. Amen. God bless each and every one of you, and thank you for supporting Center for Arizona Policy, and Merry Christmas. Goodbye.